we didn't even realize. We had built by far the most modern and the most sophisticated small brewery in the world. But we were like the home brewers I was talking about back in Oakland 20 years ago. We were still hesitant. We didn't realize what we had done. We were still scared to death that the beer would go sour any day and that we would get caught trying to sneak by as real brewers when in fact we didn't know what we were doing. And we didn't realize we had an absolutely stunningly, brilliantly modern, efficient, clean brewery making the most traditional kinds of beers. It was an amazing thing. The breweries in England shocked us, really. We saw only one small brewery that had anything like the orderly cleanliness and pride of tools that we had come to have as our philosophy. And we did like that little brewery. Other than that, we were quite shocked. And we were also very impressed with the combination of some tradition, but also just no end of shortcuts. They were brewing ale in England, we thought, just the way they had been brewing Anchor Steam when I bought the brewery, with a lot of shortcuts and sugar and, tricks and things. And one of the things that we saw when we were there was barley wines, which I had never really known about. And there were one or two still made in bottles. I'm sure they weren't all malt or dry hopped or anything, but they were there and in little bottles. And when we tried them, we tried everything. We tried these barley wines. We thought, now there's something with some character. This has got character. And besides that, and it's rich and flavorful and different. And why aren't these selling? And we asked people, well, who drinks the barley wine? Oh, they laughed. They said, the little old ladies drink the barley wine before they go home. They drink it before bed. And it was a joke as a product. It was like a nightcap sort of thing for grandma, you know. Well, we thought that was wrong. I was just inspired by this barley wine idea. And I've often used this example of talking to bigger brewers or people that are trying to give the spirit of our brewery to. When you have a little brewery like we had then, and even now, if you're small enough and flexible enough and proud of what you do and able to gear up and do something, you can just go home and do something. And we went home and we said, we're going to brew a barley wine. We only had 5 employees. So they all said, sure. There were Gordon and I and 3 others, you know. Oh, they said, okay, what's that? We told them, well, we're going to make it like it used to be. We're going to make an almost first work barley wine, and we're going to dry hop it. It's going to be the greatest thing there ever was. And we did it in November of 1975. And we kind of forgot about it. I don't think we bottled it for 6 months, 9 months or something like that. But we were awfully proud of it, and that's how the old Foghorn came about. We had seen that these things tended to have humorous names, and I must say, I think the amateur brewers have gotten better names even than the professionals anymore. I've seen some marvelous names, but that's how we did the old Foghorn. Then we did the pale ale for Christmas right away. Right after that, we said, okay, now we've done the barley wine, now we're going to make our version of a modern, of the way an English ale should be made today. Again, all malt, naturally carbonated, dry hopped, which none of these things existed even in England at that time. No adjuncts of any kind, whole hops. So just absolutely pure traditional ale. So we did that. That was our Christmas ale. We made 600 cases of that. We, in those days, we didn't commercialize the Christmas ale. I was scared to death that we would be run out of town for making a product, a beer that was identified with Christmas. But I didn't want to say winter brew or something. I wanted to be ornery and say Merry Christmas. So I said, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year on the label. And we gave it out to our friends, and we sold a little bit of it. We had 600 pieces of it. That would be a real collector's item, too, the 75 Christmas ale. Then we didn't have capacity to brew ales, so we couldn't keep going. We just made a Christmas ale every Christmas. And that's where the idea of the Christmas ale changing every year came from, because it had been a whole year since we brewed it, and we had new ideas and new ways of things we wanted to experiment with. So the first 2 or 3 were different, only because we thought we were learning, and we wanted to keep learning, and no one would really bother, and nobody would compare it to the previous one, so we went ahead and made them differently. Then that became a theme, which I like very much, that we give the public the gift, if you will, of taking a chance and trying to experiment just a little bit. We're getting ready, I think, to maybe print up a little pamphlet and actually tell people what we've been doing for 25 years. I think we're on number 24 now. We try every year to do something which, if you knew what, or at least one thing, which if you knew about it, you as brewers, would say, oh, that's interesting. It doesn't have to be weird or terribly risky, although we've done some pretty weird things, but things that would be very interesting from a brewer's point of view. Even some that were not wildly interesting. At one point we used a malt that was a brand new variety. Nobody was really using it yet. It had just come out on the market, and we made our Christmas ale 100% from that malt that was different that year. And then we started making it from barley grown up in Tule Lake. Anyway, so that's kind of the theme of the Christmas ale. Then the Anchor wheat beer. My friend Fred Huber, who ran a brewery in Monroe, Wisconsin, off and on over the years, used to talk about the wheat beers in Germany, and I had never had any back in the 70s, and so I decided that we should make a wheat beer. One of my jokes that I've been quoted at a lot and that I like is that I used to refer to the lighter beers as lawnmower beers. I was trying to make fun of them, but at the same time not mock them, and to kind of relate to the brewers who were making those by saying that if you've ever mowed the lawn in the old days, in the old way, with a real push lawnmower, when you get through, you want a cold beer. There's no end of people who've done some hard work in the sun and who understand that completely. You want a cold beer, and you probably don't want a heavy, dark, high alcohol beer. You want a light, thin, thirst-quenching, lower alcohol beer. This was my way of backhandedly insulting or praising the Budweisers and Millers of this world, who of course were the arch enemy. We were trying to get this idea going that a little brewery could make different beer and survive. And people used to, I mean, people didn't understand that in the early years. Anyway, I wanted to make a lawnmower beer, if you will, and prove that we could make a really interesting lawnmower beer, which is where Anchor Wheat Beer came from. I wanted to make it have it with more wheat malt than any wheat beer in the world. We still use more, we believe, more than anyone. Roughly two-thirds of the malt is wheat. And I wanted to make it in a clean style. By that I mean a top-fermenting ale yeast, but with everything just right. No wild yeast, no bacteria. I don't like either the Weisse or the Weizen beers of Europe. I wanted to make a clean, and I mean that from a brewer's point of view, I'm sure you understand what I mean, wheat beer that would be like a summer, thirst-quenching summer beer. It has evolved only slightly over the years. We made the first one in 1981, in August of 81, and since then we've modified it ever so slightly. One thing we've done is to drop the original gravity a little bit. I like it that it's a lower alcohol beer. It's down, I'm actually not positive if it's under 3.2 at the moment or not, but it's close. We've tried to do that on purpose. Very slight changes, but I think we pretty much hit the nail on the head when we started. The last beer that we've done that's a regular commercial product, we think, is the one we just come out with. I hope some of you have had it, and that's our small beer, which I don't know why it took me so long to realize, but when we make old Foghorn, we just throw the mash away, and the cows eat this 24 balling sweet mash, you know, it's just, it's absurd. So we started experimenting with sparging the old Foghorn mash and making a beer only from the spargings. No first work, just spargings. And because that's, of course, is where the tradition of small beer came from, as we understand it, which goes back thousands of years under different names. You make a stronger brew, of course, from the first runnings and maybe a little sparging, and then you make a weaker brew. I know in Europe, in villages out in the country where people are poor, they make wine that way. They make real wine, which they sell, and then they make their own wine by taking the red grape pomace, adding sugar and water, and re-fermenting it. And that way they get kind of a rosé with a little bit of character, and that's what they drink. So that's small wine, if you will. So anyway, we've made Anchor Small Beer, which is in a big 22-ounce bottle because it's easy for us to do in little projects that way, which I just think is terrific. It's very low in alcohol, 2.5, I think, by weight, and a very interestingly traditional product from that point of view. We won't make a whole lot of it unless people start buying a lot more old Foghorn. We hang on to old Foghorn for sentimental reasons. I think the idea is so good, but of course we don't sell very much. That's the end of my thoughts. I hope it's been of some interest, but I would love to try to field some questions if you realize that I do have to have my persona on.
How about your rye persuasion there?
Rye whiskey?
Yeah. How's that?
I wanted to make rye whiskey 25 years ago. I read books on brewing and distilling and food products and stuff like that. And I have, I think, a pretty well-developed intuitive sense. I like to see ahead. I saw that two things. One, that rye whiskey was the original American whiskey. It predated bourbon. Bourbon came from west of the eastern mountains where they could grow corn but couldn't get it economically to market, so they had to do something with it, and one of the things they did was make whiskey. And you could concentrate it that way, and you could afford to bring a barrel of whiskey across the mountains where you couldn't afford to bring a wagon load of corn. But rye was the original American whiskey, and apparently along the East Coast, especially when the Scotch-Irish invasion came really in the mid-late 18th century, with people who knew how to make whiskey from, of course, barley, from all, they made whiskey from rye. And I loved it that it was out of fashion. There are one or two, well, actually there are about four ryes out there. The one you see everywhere is Old Homestead. Other than that, they're not there, and especially in the West. I'll bet you none of you have ever ordered a rye on the rocks, or a rye with a chaser, or whatever, the way you might order a single malt to scotch. Rye is just kind of out of favor. And that just intrigued me, and the fact that it was the original whiskey. And I always wanted to make a rye whiskey. I had kind of this dream of doing it, partly because it is really a distilled beer, if you will. Of course, you don't put hops in the beer that you make whiskey out of, but it is sort of taking beer to the last step, and that appealed to me. And it's a long story. I had to end up changing some California law and a bunch of stuff. It's not easy to do because you don't want to offend anybody, but because I had a brewery and...
Oh, go ahead.
Anyway, we finally got a distillery going in 93, I think. I kept it secret. Here's a story for you. Whether it's true or not, we like to chuckle. We started buying rye malt because my theory was that the rye whiskeys would have been made from 100% malted rye. Talking to somebody earlier about modern malts. Modern malts are great. Way back when, they had to use decoction malting, and they had to use decoction mashing, and the brewers would use all malt, I'm sure, because they couldn't use a mix of malt and of malted barley and unmalted. The malt itself barely had the enzymatic power to convert the whole thing. You couldn't add some barley to it that wasn't malted. Nowadays, of course, the malt is so wonderful, the enzymatic power is so high, we can add all kinds of things to the mash and still convert it. I believe that the whiskey would have been made from an all malt mash, just as the Scotch whiskey, single malt Scotch whiskey, is made today from all barley malt. Americans would have used all rye malt. So we did that, and we started buying malted rye. And not too long after that, some of our copycat competitors started making rye beer, and we don't think it's any good to speak of. Of course, we wouldn't. You can guess. We don't have open minds at Anchor. We don't pretend to. We like that our monster went to our competitors and said, "Hey, you know, Anchor's buying rye malt. Don't you think you should be working on a rye beer?" And so out came some of these rye beers, and nothing came from Anchor because we had ours in wooden barrels. And so we did. We finally released our first batch of whiskey, 1,440 bottles, I think it was, a couple of years ago. We're still selling it. The people ask me, "How's the whiskey going?" I say, "It's just going great. We're not selling very much, but we got the world by the tail. We got the most traditional, wonderful American whiskey. It's pot distilled, all malt whiskey, the only pot distilled whiskey in America, the original rye whiskey. And so we got the world by the tail. It's just like the beer business was in the 60s. The world doesn't know that we have them by the tail, but we do. And that's one reason I did it. It's for morale. I'm sure you can imagine we have 1,200 competing microbrewers or small brewers today. Some of my people, my staff, have only been with us 5 or 10 years. They weren't there when we had the world by the tail. We did. We thought we had the world by the tail. We just had that wonderful feeling that you have when you know you're doing something wonderful and that you're making a great mousetrap and that the world is just probably going to come to your door. Anyway, we have that feeling now again, even on a small scale, because of the whiskey. Yes. Oh boy, my impression of the of the evolution of the industry from anchor's perspective.
Well, I'll tell you the truth.
Well, sort of the truth. We had a great thing going there for a while, and we had some good competitors who were fun to be around, the Mendocinos and Sierra Nevadas of this world. But it's been pretty much screwed up. I tell my people, it's like a hurricane. No matter how good your boat is or how well you tied it up, when a hurricane comes, you have to worry. And we have a hurricane now in the brewing business, and we're worried. We're hoping to survive. When people tell me, oh, you guys will survive. Oh, you got a great name and name. I say, well, I'm glad to hear that. But then I tell my staff, unfortunately, it looks like if we do survive, we're not going to get any credit. We are scrambling. We are competing. We have been for many years. We're thinking. We're fighting. We're trying not to beat everybody, but to survive. It is chaos out there. Many of our arch competitors are either contract brewers who don't even have breweries. And some of them have gone public and have large amounts of money. Many of them, of these people, are losing money, a lot of money. Every day they're losing money. And they can keep doing that until they run out of money. And we can't lose money. But we're scared. It's very competitive. When I say losing money, I mean the prices of the beer are now very competitive, and people have these huge investments in breweries, and they need to get the capacity. So we have now, among the microbrewers and craft brewers, and the big brewers pretending to be microbrewers, we have a really scary competitive situation. We hope that out of it will come a really happy, thriving group of really competitive, creative people like we had 10, 15 years ago. But it's been flooded by just a bunch of nonsense, frankly, in my opinion. You know, it's not hard to make fairly good beer, and people have printed up labels and contract brewing and stuff. You walk into your neighborhood store, it's just a joke. It's no wonder that the media has started joking about it. You go into Beverages and More, there are hundreds of beers that don't have any reason to be there, in our opinion. Of course, you ask for Anchor's point of view, but we love the Sierra Nevadas and the Mendocinos and the Red Hooks and the Full Sails and stuff. We don't love them to death, but you are. We created a category together. Anchor would never have made it if it hadn't been for this category that we all created together. But we're not happy. We're scared. Any other questions? Yes, sir. Well, I would say to you that it hasn't really been a criterion for us other than that I like new stuff. One of the reasons that I'm a success is that I've got Linda Rowe. I mean, our companies. I've got Linda Rowe and Mark Carpenter and Gordon McDermott and Phil Rogers, all of whom are orderly people. And I'm not, I admit it. I went to see an efficiency expert once and said, well, you're about a one, and I could get you up to about a three, but that's it. It's almost like a personality defect, I think. But I do see things ahead, and I like to do new things. I like to have the first real American whiskey in modern times. I like to have the first wheat beer. I like to have the first dry hopped ale in modern times. And I also like the purist point of view that things should have a theme. In other words, this is not just a dry hopped ale, but it's all malt and it's whole hops and all that sort of thing. So I guess it's been a theme only in that it has been a theme for our company and for me. I don't think I could honestly say we're looking at any new ideas in brewing right now. The small beer we thought was a great idea. I've heard some rumors that we weren't the first, and I'm not surprised. There's never a first in this world. But we thought it was pretty neat to make it out of old Foghorn, and I like that a lot. We're focusing on that right now. We're not working on anything other than our new Christmas sale. We're doing two interesting things this year to the Christmas sale. I can't tell you. We brewed the first one on, I was thinking about maybe you would enjoy to hear about that. We brewed the first one on Tuesday, and they were both just total disasters. I'm sure you'll appreciate that. I came to work, 9 o'clock or whatever, and I knew something was wrong. There were too many people in the brew house. And, you know, and there was a guy with an oar rowing in the mash tun. You know, you're not supposed to row in the mash tun. And I've done it many times myself. What had happened, we're not sure what happened. We think that the malt was not ground as fine as we should have. And because it comes from this farm in Tule Lake, it's completely different. It's just this one farm's malt that we use for the Christmas ale, or for the pale component of it. And it can vary from year to year. It's the same variety, but maybe this year the kernels are smaller. Anyway, we think that what happened was that it wasn't crushed as fine as it should have been, and it was stuck at the bottom physically. In other words, we had the propeller on, but it wasn't floating, you know what I mean? So it took a long time, but we did finally get it floating. It was in there an hour longer than it should have been, in the 140 degree range, and so we're not sure whether it'll be a good example or not. And then we made the second one, the same damn thing happened. I guess they tightened up a little bit on the rollers, I'm not sure. But same darn thing happened. So now we've tightened up a lot more on the rollers. You know, yeah, really. Well, it'll be pretty good. The question is, the problem is when we make the Christmas ale, the first few brews are vitally important because we need to go in there and taste them and smell them and see if we think we're getting what we thought we were getting and not overdoing it. We've done some things that if we overdid it, it would be yucky. You know, I mean, people would say, oh, God, it tastes like such and such a herb or something. And we don't want you to be able to taste any one thing. We want you to have kind of a mysterious taste. My time must be up. Yes, over there. Oh, yeah, we blend it. Sometimes we send it to Sweden. we have several, in the old days especially, we used to have several markets for Christmas ale that were isolated, like North Carolina or something. I'm not saying that's one, but, and we would have the first few brews, we would start blending, but it was too late to blend out the number one and three or something. And so we would maybe blend, but not as well as we'd like. We definitely do blend. We have to blend, especially because they're all just, you know, it's an experimental brew, and we're not really in the groove. By the time we quit, we're still not in the groove, so we do definitely blend. But we have actually sent some somewhat atypical Christmas ale to a very distant market and hope that nobody compared with the other. Last question? Yes. Yeah, we haven't released it here. We released it in New York. The only reason is that we have a terrific distributor in New York, and we were dying to get it going. The reason we haven't released it here is we're about to change distributors. We asked our master wholesaler as a beer distributor to distribute it to get a license and distribute it. We couldn't do it ourselves. There is a three-tier system in California for spirits, not for wine or beer, but the distillery cannot deliver to the retailer his own spirits. We asked our distributor to distribute our whiskey for us as a fee. We're going to a wine and spirits wholesaler named Chambers & Chambers. They're going to have my wine also, which is releasing a wine from my vineyard after 30 years and finding new wine. But I'm going to have the same distributor doing both, which I think will be convenient for me. We just didn't want to confuse him and say, look, you got to take on the gin, but we're going to take it away from him. It just doesn't seem like a good thing. So we're just waiting. It'll be a week or so. No, it'll be in stores and restaurants. It's priced at the top vodka level. If you go to the gin section where the herbs and botanicals are, in true gins, you know, you really do distill. You can make a fake gin with flavors. But if it says distilled dry gin, it's literally distilled with the authentic botanicals in the still, which is how we made ours. And if you go to the gin section, the prices are all more or less the same, and there's not enough price there to make a profit for a little guy to have fun. So we looked around and saw that in the vodka section, which where there's no flavor at all by definition, nonetheless there's a higher price tier, the Grey Goose and those special vodkas are supposedly special. So we priced our gin at that top vodka price, hoping that the public will accept that, and they just seem to be in New York. One of the problems is that you can't make it like the Angostine in the old days. Who's going to buy it? If you have a gin that's delicious, but it's way too expensive, who's going to buy it? Because the bars are going to say, well, we're going to charge extra for a martini made with your gin. That's not going to work. And they can maybe charge a little extra, but not a whole. And so it was a tricky question. I think that it's wonderful gin. I think if any of you bite, Mr. Chin, and taste it, you'll agree that it's fun. It's quite, or rather, intense in character. I think it reminds me a little bit of the spruce beer that we made here. I said there's only two ways to make spruce beer, with too much spruce or too little. Because nobody knows how much is ideal. I mean, you'd have to make it for years before you knew, you see, and then you might disagree. The last thing we want is for someone to taste our spruce beer and say, I don't taste any spruce. So the only thing you can do is to put in too much. And so everybody who tasted our spruce beer said, oh, that's way too much spruce. And I agree, it was. The only time I ever really enjoyed it was drinking it outdoors. There was something about being outdoors that it made it good. So we did the same thing with the gin. We wanted to make a gin. How are you going to make a gin? Well, have fun. It's interesting. It's characterful. We got a lot of experiment with all these different botanicals. We had a hell of a good time. But ultimately, we decided we want ours to have a little more. We want it to be a little more. And more of what is up to you to decide, but we think it's just a little more intense. So it's fun. We have some other things coming from the distillery.